Thanks for joining us today on this episode of History to War Games podcast. For those of you that might be new, welcome. I'm your host, Rob. There are many co-hosts and guests that join me to discuss history and war games. The history in this episode may be a first-hand account, live history event, or chat with a published author. The visual spectacle of historical wargaming may be discussed to further understand the decisions of the officers on the field. So let's blend for you the history to war games and provide a unique insight in today's episode. Welcome, listeners, to the History to War Games podcast. Tonight we have a special guest, a person of that actually had his father serve in World War II, which is rare. Most of the time it's usually grandfathers, great uncles, people of those sorts. This is actually a person whose father actually served in World War II. And just like this story, and as we've had authors before, sometimes these stories don't always have a happy ending, but we'll get that to that later in the podcast tonight. So I'd like to welcome Steve Snyder to the podcast. Welcome, Steve.
Hi there. Glad to be here. Yeah, appreciate it.
Yeah, thanks for joining us. I'm glad you reached out to me, and from our off-air discussion, off the air, it was interesting to hear about how busy you are publicizing the book you have here. And let me, for listeners' sake, let me tell you, the title of the book is called Shot Down, Story of Pilot Howard Snyder and the Crew of the B-17 Susan Ruth. Tell the listeners, because you just told me off air, how many air shows are you going to, how are you publicizing this book, and where do you go all the time?
Okay, well, I keep busy. I actually retired from my career job in 2009. But since I wrote the book, I'm basically working full time again, promoting the book. I spend hours every day on social media, contacting anyone who might buy the book or promote the book. And I do a lot of public speaking. I have developed a couple of PowerPoint presentations. So I make a lot of presentations to all sorts of different groups around the United States, primarily more so in Southern California where I live. But I also go to a number of air shows around the United States where I sign copies of my book. There's quite a few air and war museums around the country that are associated with air shows, and they sell my book, and I sign copies of them. So I stay real busy. It's a bit, like I say, it's basically a full-time job, but it's my passion. It's what I love to do, and I don't know how long I'll keep doing this. We'll see, but I really enjoy it.
No, it's fantastic. It gets me to think about, when did you start writing this book? When was the first inception of this book?
Well, that's a good question, Rob. As I mentioned, I retired in 2009, and that's when I had the time to really delve into my dad's war history in more detail. Growing up, I knew the basics of his World War II history. I knew he was a B-17 pilot. He was stationed with the 8th Air Force in England. His plane was named the Susan Ruth after my oldest sister, who was 1 year old at the time that he went overseas. And he flew bombing missions over occupied Europe and Germany. And in February of 1944, he was shot down, and he was missing in action for 7 months, but he evaded capture and eventually got back to England. But when I retired, I wanted to go through all the material that my parents had kept from the war years. And at that time, I had no intention at all of writing a book. My parents had kept quite a few things. Two items were most significant. One was a diary that my dad wrote while he was missing in action about his plane being shot down, and that was absolutely riveting. So much so that it was included in a couple books that were written. One was called The Mighty Eighth by Gerald Astor about the 8th Air Force, which was stationed in England. And the other book was First Over Germany by Russell Strong, which was about the 306 bomb group, which my dad was in. The 306 motto was First Over Germany. That was the name of the book because they were the first bomb group to hit a target in Germany. And the other item were all the letters that my dad wrote to my mother while he was stationed in England. And he was very candid in those letters. He talked about bombing missions, what life was like on the base, what life was like in England and London at the time, escapades of him and his crew. And reading those letters were absolutely fascinating. And I just became fascinated with the story of my dad and his crew, and it became my passion. And I wanted to learn more and more. So I started reading book after book about the air war over Europe. I went on the internet and spent countless hours doing research, downloading declassified military documents. I started joining a number of World War II organizations and started going to their reunions and listening to veterans tell their stories. And finally, in 2012, I came to the conclusion that the story of my dad and his crew was so unique and so compelling that it needed to be told and people needed to know about it. So I decided to write a book.
Wow. I mean, that's, for some reason, I was thinking that your dad didn't come back. He came back from the war then.
Yeah, or else I wouldn't be here.
Okay. For some reason, I was thinking all along that your father didn't make it. So we all know he was shot down as a B-17. So he wrote these letters before he went over. How many missions did he fly into Germany and into those sorts?
Well, he was shot down on his eighth mission. Some of his crew had more missions than him. A B-17 had a 10-man crew, four officers and six enlisted men. But he didn't have as many missions as some of his other crew members because he was the center on the basketball team there, and he tore the ligaments in his ankle, and he couldn't fly for a couple months. But he was shot down on his eighth mission.
His eighth mission, he was shot down. Yeah, I just, for some reason, I was thinking that he didn't make it back. So that's good. That's good to hear. So that said, he wrote letters home. They were not censored letters then, as you're saying. They were uncensored letters to a point.
He was the first pilot, and as such, he was the commander of the plane and the crew, and he censored the letters that his crew wrote, but his letters weren't censored. So most people that I talk to, and I talk a lot of people at these presentations I make and air shows that I go to, and you know, most people know very little about their vet, whether it's their father or grandfather or uncle. And the guys that did write letters, most of the stuff was just, I'm fine, it's cold, and that's about it. I was just very fortunate that there was so much information in my dad's letters about what was taking place. And those letters really formed the backbone of the book.
I guess one question I have right now is, did he tell you stories when you were growing up?
Well, yeah, he talked to some, but like most World War II veterans, he didn't talk a lot about it. It wasn't until 1989 that a memorial was erected in southern Belgium to my dad and his crew, and he and the other three living members of the crew went over for the dedication. And at the dedication, he was reunited with lots of the Belgian people that hid him from the Germans during the war. Went to visit some of those houses where he stayed, and that brought it all back. And after that, he started talking quite a bit about it. I've been to Belgium four times. My first trip over there was in 1994, fortunately with my parents. My wife and I went over there, and that's when it became personal for me because I saw everything firsthand and was able to meet a couple of his helpers that were still living.
That's great. And did you pull some of those stories together for the book too? Did you record them or write down some of the stories that they said about your father?
Yes, the story about my dad and his crew is completely factual. It's all based on firsthand testimony by the people who were involved in the events that took place, either member of my dad's crew, members of the Belgium underground, or declassified military documents like bomb group mission reports, bomb squadron diaries,
sure,
things such as that. And some of the other crew members wrote little accounts. And when those four guys went over for the dedication, one of my dad's waist gunners, Joe Musial, he filmed the whole thing and on a camcorder. And so that gave me a lot of information because as they were walking around and visiting various houses and places, these four guys would talk about it, their experiences.
Oh, right.
But I probably wouldn't have written a book if it wasn't for two Belgian gentlemen.
Really? How did they help you out?
Well, one was named Dr. Paul Delahaye, and the other is Jacques Lalot. and they were young boys during the war, and they were greatly affected by it. They saw firsthand the atrocities that the Nazis committed against their family and friends. And later on in life, they became local historians, and they interviewed lots of Belgian people and members of the underground about events that took place involving my dad and his crew, and they documented that testimony. And they gave me unbelievably detailed information about events that would have been lost forever without their dedicated research. So I owe them a great debt. And they're wonderful men. Unfortunately, Dr. Delahaye passed away in 2013. But Jacques Lowe, he's 80 years old now, and we're very good friends. So I can't thank them enough for all the information that they gave to me.
Yeah, definitely.
Plus, they gave me a lot of photographs, too, that are in the book.
Oh, wow. That raises an interesting question. These were Belgian kids, per se, that were in war-torn Europe during this period of time. And I'm only curious for this point is how did they see even the invasion in 1940? How did that affect them? Did they talk anything about that?
Oh, yes. Their world was turned upside down when the Germans invaded Belgium and the Nazis took over. They were under extreme hardship. If they got caught doing anything against the Germans, they could be arrested, interrogated, tortured, shot, sent to concentration camps. Especially those people that helped down airmen like my dad and a few other members of his crew were unbelievably brave because they risked their lives and those of their families to help these downed airmen. And several of the Belgian people that helped my dad and his crew were arrested, went to prison. Some were killed. Unbelievable.
Yeah. No, it's just interesting that you never really hear the civilian take on, how was occupied Europe during those 5 years kind of thing. So interesting point there. Let's rewind a little bit and go backwards and talk about where did your father enlist and how did his enlistment start for World War II?
Okay. Well, my dad was actually born in North Fork, Nebraska, where Johnny Carson's from, or was from.
Yeah.
And he moved to Southern California with his family when he was 13. Attended Glendale High School, where he was the captain on the basketball team. And as a result of the first peacetime draft in history implemented by President Franklin Roosevelt in the fall of 1940, my dad enlisted in Los Angeles in April of 1941. And initially, he didn't go into the Air Force. He went into the Army. And he was stationed at Fort Lewis, Washington. He was in the infantry. But then 3 months later, after he went into the Army, he married my mother, Ruth Hempel. She was from Pasadena. And then on December 7th of 1941, Pearl Harbor was bombed by Japan, and the United States was at war. Well, my mother was really concerned about the future. So things were so uncertain at that time. So she went up to visit my dad in Washington over Christmas. And 9 months later, Susan Ruth was born. So my dad was concerned how he was going to be able to support his new bride and his baby on the way. He didn't think he could do it very well on a private's pay in the Army. So he decided to enlist and volunteer for the Air Force where he could make more money, especially if he could make it through pilot training to become an officer. So that's how he got into the military.
Gotcha. No, that's interesting because he kind of transferred services just so he could get in the Air Force. And from that point, where was his training at? What was his position also that he was trained for?
Well, The guys that volunteered for pilot training, first they went through pre-flight training. My dad took that at Santa Ana Army Air Base in Southern California. And they went through a number of tests. And if you passed the pre-flight training, you went to primary training. My dad did that at Santa Maria, California, at John Hancock Aeronautical College. That's where they would first solo. They trained on a old Stearman biplane in primary training. And pilot training was really rough. 40% of the guys that started did not make it through. They washed out. And those guys usually became bombardiers or navigators. But if you made it through primary training, then you went to basic training. My dad did that at Lemoore, California, and Marana, Arizona. And there he flew single-wing planes, Vultee Valiant. And then after basic training, it was kind of interesting. They separated the pilots out before they went into advanced pilot training. Because in advanced pilot training, they had you could either go into single-engine planes or fighters or multi-engine planes, bombers or transports. Typically, the smaller pilots went into fighters because of the cramped condition in the cockpits. But I personally feel it also depended a lot about on personality. Seems to me those fighter pilots tended to have pretty big egos, be risk takers, kind of cocky, independent, where the bomber pilots tended to be more team players and a little level-headed. My dad was 6'3". You know, he went into to bombers, and he went through advanced pilot training at Douglas, Arizona, and he graduated in April of 1943, where he received his commission as a second lieutenant and his pilot's wings. And from then, he went into transitional training down in Pyote, Texas, where he learned how to fly a four-engine B-17 bomber. And then from there, went on to operational crew training at Dalhart, Texas, where the various members of the crew came together and they learned to operate as a team. And then once they were deemed ready, they were shipped overseas.
That's a great point that I never realized, that the teams were actually formed before they went overseas, not when they were overseas. So that's an interesting
Correct.
point. So that's a something to think about, is that these guys had to become efficient, didn't they? They had some efficiency tests to make sure they were qualified to go over to Europe, didn't they?
Yeah, you know, the gunners would practice gunning, and you know, the bombardiers would practice bombing. The navigators would practice navigation, you know, to try to hone their skills. Although back then, they churned these guys out pretty fast. The training, well, my dad went in for pre-flight in April of 42, and then he graduated from advanced pilot training in April of 43, and then in October of 43, he was sent overseas. So the training was relatively quick. A lot of these guys kind of had to learn on the job when they were over in England.
Was it so? It's not so much hours for them, probably. It was more about just being qualified. You know, sometimes it's about all about flight hours or how many hours you have in the air. Is that kind of my understanding?
Well, they've had to pass, you know, proficiency tests and, you know, bombing tests and you know, flying in formation and, you know, night flying and a number of things that they did to be deemed ready.
Yeah. No, it's great. It's great. So he's done training. I always like to ask even my veterans, I ask the same question. How does he get from Texas to the UK? What is their transport process? They're not flying these B-17s across country and across the ocean, are they? Or are they hitting in a ship? How's that working for him?
Well, actually, yes. After they were assigned overseas to the European Theater of Operations, he and his crew, they first went to Scott Field in Illinois, where they did some more training. And then they went to Bangor, Maine for a little while, where they did some more training. Then they went up to Newfoundland, where they kind of gathered together. And then from Newfoundland, let me go step back. And at Scott Field in Illinois, they got a brand new B-17, and they flew that to Maine and then to Newfoundland, and they flew actually that plane across the Atlantic to England.
Wow.
Not all the crews flew planes over to England. The guys earlier in the war all did. Some of the crews later in the war, you know, went over by ship,
Right,
by
right.
boat. But my dad and his crew at that time, because it was the fall of 43, they flew, and you know, guys got lost and went down over the Atlantic, were never heard from again.
That's a great point. So there was, B-17 lost, airplanes lost, over the Atlantic kind of thing, and you would never think about how how these B, you know, how do we get flights in squadrons of B-17s to the UK? They just, as you said, they flew them over, you know, and that would be the probably the most efficient way to get them over there.
And my dad said it was pretty scary because, you know, it's pitch black, you know, it's nighttime and you can't see anything, you know, can't tell the ground from the sky. And so they had a few, you know, they were sweating a little bit
Yeah, can
flying that plane over the Atlantic.
it's hard to tell where the horizon is, I guess you'd say.
Yeah.
So, no, it's great. So this brand new B-17, is this the one that they're going to have the rest of the war, or are they reassigned a different one?
Unfortunately, no. As soon as they got to England, they took that plane away from them. They got it. They gave the new planes to more experienced crews.
Really? Huh.
Yeah, and
Okay.
so my dad got and his crew. They got an old beat up B-17.
Yeah.
In Europe, there were actually three different models of B-17s that were used at the beginning of the war, the air war in August of 1942.
What
When
was
the
the
8th Air Force first went over there, they used what was called an E model, but there were only about 500 E models of the B-17s manufactured, so they were quickly phased out by the F model, which was really the first combat-ready B-17. And then they were replaced in the fall of 43, or the end of 43, by the G model, and that was really the definitive model. On the F model, there were about 3,400 of those made. The G model, there are about 8,600 of those made. And the distinguishing feature between the G model and the F model was the G model had a chin turret underneath the nose of the plane. That's how you can always tell the G model.
Really, the F1s didn't have
They didn't have a chin turret.
really, how about that? That's interesting. Yeah, I would never think that there'd be three different models of B-17s, but again, it's evolution during World War II. They keep improving, these planes that make them more efficient and stronger and those kind of things. So that's.
Yeah, they needed to add the chin turret because with the F model without the chin turret, the German Luftwaffe pilots, the Air Force pilots, they would come in from the front because the bombers couldn't really protect themselves,
Oh,
and so
interesting.
they had to add that chin turret. It was twin guns in the chin turret to help fight off the German fighters coming from head on.
Yeah.
They like to come in. They like to come in from 12 o'clock high. You know, that's
Yeah.
from the front.
That's interesting. I saw a B-17 over the summer, and he had dual machine guns in the front chin there, and he must have been a G
Right.
model.
That's a G model.
Yeah. Which is the Texas, I think it's called the Texas Raider. I think it was his name.
Yeah, all the B-17s that are touring today are all G models that were built really at the end of the war, after the war. None of them saw any combat.
Yeah, that's very interesting. The so when does he when so he gets this was he assigned a G model then? Because you said he had to give away his brand new air.
No, that it was the F model that he flew over to England, and then when he got there, he got an old F model.
Oh wow.
He
Okay.
didn't. He finally got a G model, but on his most of the missions that he flew an F model.
Got it.
It
Okay.
wasn't until his last two missions that he got a brand new G model to fly,
Got it. Gotcha.
and then they got shot down.
So this is always a curiosity for me, is when do they get to name their airplane? When did they get to put on again, he named the airplane after who? What's the story behind that?
My oldest sister, who was
Oldest,
1 year old at the time that he went overseas,
right. So
Susan Ruth.
his firstborn, he named his airplane after this firstborn. Is he the
Right.
is he the pilot or co-pilot in this B-17?
He's the pilot.
Pilot.
He
Okay.
had technically the first pilot, and then you had a co-pilot.
Right. Okay. So he.
And as because the pilot was the commander of the plane and the crew, he had the final say in what the plane was named.
Yes. And what were some of the voting? What were some of the other ones that they might have came up with? Did you happen to have any information for that?
Well, of the 10-man crew, of my dad's crew, and a crew was always referred to by their pilot's name, even though a crew had a number. They always referred to a crew as like Joe Smith's crew or Howard Snyder's crew.
Oh,
That's
okay.
just the way it went. There was
Yeah.
never a crew 3, 6, 7, 8. or that was always the pilot.
Yeah.
And of the crew, there were only three that were married, and my dad was the only one that had a child. So I guess, for lack of a better name for the plane, they decided that they'd name it after my dad's daughter.
Yeah, he wins by default, right? So,
Kind
yeah.
of.
No, it's great. It's the we always wonder how these planes are getting named and those sorts. We always see these really nice, names on the front of these B-17s, and you're always curious to see how they do name them. So,
It's interesting to note that the Air Force was the only entity that allowed their planes to be painted. The Marines didn't, nor did the Navy or other countries. But the Air Force, the 8th Air Force, thought it would help the morale of these young guys if they could personalize their planes by naming them and painting them. And they were very creative in what they named and painted on their planes. Many times it was a cartoon character, but most often it was a scantily clad or nude woman.
Right. No,
These guys were in their late, teens and early 20s. They were virile young men.
yeah, sure. No, that's an interesting point because you do see this on some of the U.S. tanks though, but not to the effect of the way that they're painting these B-17s. So, interesting point. So he's going over. Where is he stationed in the U.K.? What's his air base that he's at then?
On October 21st of 1943, he and his crew were assigned to the 306 Bomb Group at Thurlow, England. Thurlow is located north of London, about 60 miles, just a little bit northwest of London, in an area called East Anglia. That's where all the air bases were located in England, in an area called East Anglia, which was about the size of a month.
Yeah.
And at the peak, there were within the 8th Air Force, there were 40 bomber bases. And then you have all these fighter bases. Then you have the Royal Air Force bases. So East Anglia was just packed with air bases.
Wow, I didn't realize that. That's a lot of squadrons, right? There's a lot of tell us where the
Well,
quick. Go ahead.
within the 8th Air Force, there were three air divisions, and then with each. In each air division, there were four combat wings. And in each combat wing, there were three bomb groups. And in each bomb group, there were four bomb squadrons.
Wow. How many planes in a squadron, just really quick?
Well, it varied, but typically about a dozen.
Okay. And per airfield, it would be a squadron, or would it be a
Bomb group.
bomb group?
There'd
So
be
you could.
four squadrons at that bomb group.
Wow.
At that base.
That's a lot. That's a lot of planes. So he's stationed there in London. And how does he you said you wrote some letters home. How does he get this liberty of time to write these letters? And is he going into London and stuff for his R&R?
Well, occasionally, they had a lot of downtime because the weather in England was so bad. It was so overcast and socked in so often that there were many days that they couldn't fly because the weather was just too bad. So they did have a lot of time. They trained constantly when they could, when they weren't going on missions. And then when they'd get a pass or a leave, they'd go into the little villages near the base, or if they had a 2 day pass or a little longer, they could take a train into London and then have fun in London. And at the time, there was no city in the world like London. I mean, this was kind of, well, that was at the very end of the British Empire. One time, the British Empire, I think it was controlled like a fifth of the land in the world. And during the war, with all those Western European countries being occupied, you had a lot of people that fled over there. So you had people from all over the world in London, and it was a fabulous place. These guys had never seen anything like that. Most of the back then, the United States was a very rural country. The majority of the people lived on farms or outside the cities, and a lot of these young guys, they'd never been out of their hometown or their county, and all of a sudden They were halfway around the world, you know, in England. Their eyes must have been bugging out. You know, some of these guys, they just got out of high school.
Yeah,
It's amazing.
and most of them were probably country kids. You know, they probably had never been to New York or Chicago.
Oh,
Even
yeah.
especially West Coast California is probably very rural. You know, not a lot of buildings going on there. So it's probably to go all over the world. And London at that time, just like you're saying, is probably one of the biggest cities in the world for both, you know, refugees, but also for the population and the industry and everything else. So. Interesting point that you said.
Also, the U.S. airmen, well, also the GIs, they were paid. What they were paid was about five times what the British military guys were paid. So they had a lot of money. So all those English girls kind of were aware of that, and they that these GIs had a lot of money to spend on them, to take them to bars or buy them, you know, give them nylons, give them cigarettes, give them chocolate. So there was a lot of fraternizing. And that's in my book. There's a section in my book that I talk about the interaction between the English people and the GIs. It's quite fascinating. There were like 50,000 war brides in England that came back to the United States.
Really? I didn't realize that
Yeah.
the British
A
did that.
lot of kids born out of wedlock too.
Wow. Huh. And I didn't realize that they got paid five times. So that's an interesting point too, is they got a lot of money coming in. You know, they're not being paid in US dollars, being paid in, you know, British pound or whatever it was, at that time.
So
So
they had a lot of money to, relatively speaking, to spend.
yeah. No, it's a great point. Anything that sticks out that was in the book that is a story that might be something you might want to share with listeners?
As far as like in England and London's
Yeah, his kind
concerned,
of his what he saw, the sights that he saw, those kind of things, maybe cities he visited.
well, he commented, and that I there's lots of excerpts from my dad's letters in the book that talk about this. But he was fascinated by it. You know, they had gone through endured the Battle of Britain and the Blitz. And so, you know, the area was pretty bombed out, and they had at night, you know, everything was they had that blackout, so you could he'd say you couldn't see a thing. You try to, you know, there were no lights, no street lights. The headlights on any cars, you know, had to be blacked on top, so you couldn't find your way around hardly at all. He said that was really, really tough, but really. No story in particular. There's some funny things that are in the book. I'll just leave it to people to read the book to pick those up.
Yeah, no, it's perfect. That's good because I have a lots of UK listeners. I was only curious to see if any of their cities that they're living in right now would pop up in your stories. I think we probably have 3,000, maybe 3,200 listeners a month that are from the UK. So I was just curious for their sake, for our UK listeners. So.
Yeah, I've been to England a couple times. I've the base there at Thurlow is no longer there, but there's a nice little museum. The closest town to Thurlow would be Bedford,
Okay, nice.
and I stayed there. The English people are wonderful. They are still very grateful for the Yanks coming over and helping them battle the Germans. So
Yeah.
they're great people. I have a lot of friends over in England. A lot of people bought my book from the UK.
Perfect. That's fantastic. That's great to hear. So we've kind of set it all up for this infamous mission. What so we know on the eighth mission he gets shot down. How do the first seven missions go for him? What kind of things was he doing on the first seven? What kind of highlights were there? Did he shoot down any German airplanes?
His first mission was on November 3rd of 1943. It was the first time that the 8th Air Force put up over 500 bombers on a mission. The 8th Air Force got the nickname the Mighty Eight. Actually, it was coined by my mind's escaping me here. I'll think of it in a minute. But
Yeah.
a noted Roger Freeman, a noted historian, and he's named Eight, Air Force, the Mighty Eight, because of the number of the planes that they could put up on these bombing missions, which, you know, numbered into the hundreds. And on December 24th of 1944, there were 2,000 bombers that hit Berlin.
Wow.
I can't even imagine 2,000 bombers in the sky. That must have been a sight to behold. But anyway, his first mission was on November 1st. It was to Wilhelmshaven, Germany. And that mission went pretty smooth. He thought it was pretty easy, but they started getting tougher. And, it was flying combat was brutal and really dangerous. And it was dangerous from the time that they took off, from the time they landed. To begin with, as I mentioned, there were all those bomber bases located in East Anglia, and they were only about 5 to 10 miles apart. So on the day of a mission, you had hundreds of bombers taken off from these bases all at the same time, and typically the weather was lousy. Back then, there was no air traffic control, there was no radar, so everything was based on visual sight. And so you couldn't see anything until you got above the cloud layer. So mid-air collisions were not uncommon. And then they had to form up. As I also mentioned earlier, you know, all those individual planes had to form up into squadrons and the bomb groups and the combat wings and the air divisions. And all that took an hour to 2 hours before they could even head across the English Channel to begin their mission. And then they had to deal with the elements. These planes weren't pressurized, so above 10,000 feet, they had to go on oxygen or else they would pass out and be dead in a few minutes. And it was extremely cold as well. It was minus 40 to 60 degrees below zero. So frostbite was a huge problem. A lot of guys were hospitalized for lengthy periods of time because of serious frostbite injuries. And one of my dad's waist gunners, John Pindrock, he was hospitalized for about 2 months because he suffered serious frostbite injuries. And my dad's ball turret gunner, he got injured and was out. A lot of people kind of visualize that these guys flew the same planes on every mission and it was the same crew on every mission. But that was not the case, especially early in the war, maybe later on in the war, in the late 44, 45. But in the early couple years of the war, these guys flew different planes all the time because these planes would have battle damage or mechanical damage, and so they'd fly in another plane. And then the crews, everyone was getting sick all the time with the flu or pneumonia because of the damp weather. And so you're always replacing crewmen, either because they were sick or they got injured on a previous mission. So it was very seldom early in the year, early on in the war, that these guys all flew together in the same plane. I kind of digressed there, but I was talking about these combat missions. And so once they reached the coast of continental Europe, then their next problem was that they had to face the German fighters. Germany had radar stations along the coast of continental Europe, so they knew when these bomber formations were coming, and they'd send up the Air Force, the Luftwaffe, to intercept them. So they had to battle the Luftwaffe, and the 8th Air Force took devastating losses in the first couple years in the war, in 42 and 43, and we can talk about that a little more later.
Yeah.
And then the final thing they had to deal with was all the anti-aircraft fire, the flak.
Yeah, it's a great point. Just to raise a couple questions for the first seven missions is does he remember, did he ever relay his thoughts of the first time he saw a German fighter in the sky? Was he scared? What was the impression he had right away for that one?
He never mentioned about the first time he saw an enemy fighter, but he did say that, it was kind of like, I guess, going into a athletic event or something, any really event where you're nervous before that things start, and then once you're in it, you kind of your nerves go away. Well, that's kind of the way my dad talked about it. Once he got up there, you know, and flying the plane and in the midst of things, you know, he really didn't get nervous. I mean, his adrenaline would be pounding. He would say that even though it was so cold in those plains, his adrenaline would be running through him so much that he'd just be perspiring fusely, and his clothes would be wringing wet just from the anxiety and the tenseness of the situation. Because you have these enemy planes firing at you, and then when you go through near the target, you have all that flak. Those flak guns were extremely deadly. They fired 20 shells a minute, and the shells were calibrated to explode at the same altitude that the planes were flying. And these shells were filled with all different shapes and sizes of razor-sharp metal called shrapnel that would burst out hundreds of feet and could easily penetrate the thin aluminum skin on these bombers. The skin on these planes was so thin you could take a screwdriver and just poke it right through it. And so once you got closer to these, from a distance, they looked like kind of innocent black puffs. But as they got closer, these puffs got bigger. The noise of the explosions got louder. And if one exploded near the ship, it would just violently rock the ship. So I can't imagine the chaos and the noise that are involved in these bomb runs.
Yeah, no, it's a great point. I always wonder, the accuracy of, we always watch the anti-aircraft guns shooting in the into the sky with puffs of smoke of the flak. To have the range, to already know the range and those sorts, it seems like they missed a lot, but they must have hit sometimes, right?
Oh yeah. I mean, if you got a hit directly, the plane would basically just disappear in thin air, just disintegrate. Or if it knocked a wing off, the plane would just drop to the earth like a stone. I mean, and when you're up there in your plane, and then you look out and you see, another bomber disappear before your eyes, or another one just plummet. And they always looked for chutes to see if guys were able to bail out, and sometimes they were chutes, sometimes there weren't. So, they at any moment, could be their last as they went into that killing field of flak. If one they got a hit, they never knew.
Yeah, that's a great point. That did he see other planes get shot down? Is that something that he remembers, or that you found out?
In fact, on one mission, he didn't realize it at the time. But one of his good friends that he went through pilot training with, the plane in front of him just exploded and blew up. And he didn't know who it was at the time, but later he found out it was one of his good pilot buddies.
Oh wow, huh? And that's just how it is when you're in combat. For a lot of these guys, you only know what's in front of you, and you don't realize what happened until after the fact. So, and just like,
Yeah, I mean, you're just concentrating on your job, and that's it.
yeah, and just like you said, it's not that it's just like an athletic competition or something along those lines, where it's you're not nervous during the action, or you're not nervous during the competition, or not nervous while you're up in the air. It's the nerves of sitting on the ground, knowing you have to go through that process over and over and over. And that's maybe what wore on him the most. Is did he see other crews kind of fail and kind of refuse? Did he see any mutinies like that? Did he see anything like that?
Well, sitting on the ground, my dad said that what really he bugged him was missions that were what they call scrubbed or canceled. Because you went through all the anxiety of going on a mission.
Oh, right.
You knew that the night before your name was posted, you're going, you had to get up early, get briefed, go out to your plane. Sit in your plane, you had to, take off, and it was always dangerous talk taking off, and you formed up, and then if the weather was over the target was bad, you had to turn around and come back. And that didn't count as a mission, even though you went through all that anxiety.
Oh my. That raises a great point, though, is who's making the call about the weather over the target? Are there spotter planes out there? Are there scouts out there? How are they making these calls?
Well, the 8th Bomber Command would make that call and communicate to the various bomb groups about whether it was a go or not. But they did have, weather guys and to chart the weather, and there were some planes that would give them information.
Yeah, I was just curious because you always see
But
some.
sometimes you didn't know until you got right over the target.
Oh, wow. Huh.
Because it might be clear. The mission, these missions lasted 6 to 10 hours, so it was really grueling. Being in these old, back then it was state of the art, but today, you look at it and, they leaked, rain came through, there was all wet inside, and, they bounced all around. That's
Yeah, no, it's just an interesting point, the crews and those sorts going through all the drama that they do. Again, we see this new movie coming out by Tom Hanks called The Mighty Eighth, and I want to kind of save the story of your father being shot down for part two here. But have you seen any? Were you contacted for that movie or anything along those sorts for this from doing this book?
No, that was that movie is actually based on another book, Masters of the Air, by
Okay.
Donald Miller,
Yeah.
and it might even be called Masters of the Air. I don't know if they decided on a exact title.
Right, sure.
Yeah, that'll be the it's going to be a 10-part episode or miniseries on HBO, and it's going to be the most expensive television production in history. It's going to cost $500 million. Which was more than the Band of Brothers and the Pacific combined. It should be spectacular, but when that's gonna be out, I don't know. I think
Right.
we're li at least looking at 2020 myself.
Yeah, sure. I was just curious because I was thinking when you said the Mighty Eighth a little bit a while ago, I was thinking that was kind of the name or the feeder line for that new movie. So no, it's good. Let's take a break here and we will entertain our listeners with part two and about how your father shot down and his escape. How about that?
Okay.
Welcome, listeners, back from the break. This part, we're going to get into the story about how Steve's father was shot down over Belgium. So, tell us how did the day start for mission number eight for him, and how did it go? And is he still on the ship on the B-17 that he was assigned to?
Well, he had finally got a new ship. My dad always referred to the bomber or the plane as a ship.
Yeah, that's interesting, but yeah.
Yeah, and I've noticed other pilots have done that the same. They called it a ship. But he did get a new ship, a brand new B-17G model that they flew on his seventh mission. And actually, the seventh mission and his eighth mission were the only two missions that his complete crew flew together. They were just broken up because of, as I mentioned earlier, because of injury or illness. His co-pilot, George Ike, he was from Rochester, New York. He was assigned as a co-pilot. He was a pretty good pilot himself, but he was assigned to a co-pilot, to a pilot who it was. I don't know what, I don't want to say a little bit shaky, but not up to par maybe to some of the others. And my dad was really frustrated by that he couldn't get his co-pilot, but he finally got him back for the seventh mission and then the eighth mission. So on the eighth mission, it was February 8th of 1944. He and his complete crew took off. They were on a bombing mission to Frankfurt, Germany. And they dropped their bombs successfully, but their bomb bay doors got hit by flak and they couldn't get them back up. And as a result, that caused a drag on the plane. They lost airspeed and they started lagging behind the formation. I should mention that when the formation started their bomb run, it was at a point called the IP initial point, which is about 20 to 50 miles from the target. At that time, they couldn't do any evasive action at all. And then once they dropped the bombs, they went to they made a big curving turn and they went to another pre-designated point called the rally point, where these planes that made it through the bomb run tried to form back up to head back to England. So anyway, they were lagging behind the formation a little bit, and their fighter escorts at the time, unfortunately, they left the bomber formation for about 20 minutes to go in to chase these German fighter planes and get into dogfights, and that left the formation vulnerable. And so here the formation was vulnerable. My dad's plane was lagging behind the formation a little bit, and they were singled out by two Focke-Wulf German 190 fighters, which came in for the kill. And in the ensuing air battle, the Susan Ruth was shot down. Two of the 10 crew members were killed in the plane. The other eight were able to bail out successfully. Although both those Focke-Wulf German fighters were shot down too. One was piloted by Siegfried Merrick, and his plane crashed in Belgium, and he was killed in the plane. And the other was piloted by Lieutenant Hans Berger. He was able to bail out, and he made it through the war. During my research, one day my wife just casually asked me, "Well, why don't you try to find the German pilot that shot down your dad's plane?" I thought to myself, you know, I didn't tell her this, but, you know, that's an idiotic question. You know, there's no way in the world I could find him. But like a good husband, I did what she told me to do. You know, I figured he probably died during the war. If he didn't die during the war, it's been 70 years. You know, he probably passed away since then. And I can't, even if he's alive, I can't speak German. But lo and behold, I found Hans Berger.
Wow.
And fortunately for me, he became a translator after the war and speaks English.
Wow.
And for the book, I interviewed him through email and over the phone, and he gave me some wonderful information about what it was like to go up against the 8th Air Force, which is in the book. Since then, I've been to Munich, Germany, where Hans lives today. And we've become good friends. He's 94 years old right now, and we've become pretty good friends. So when I went over there, I filmed an interview with him, and I've also filmed in Belgium. I plan to make a documentary about the book that I'm working on right now.
Yeah, that's fantastic. How established was this fighter pilot? How long had he been serving, the German fighter pilot?
He started in pretty much around what my dad did, the fall of, he just started in the fall of 44, so he came in a little bit late. No, excuse me, the fall of 43, same as my dad, I'm sorry. So he shot down 8 planes. He shot down 7 B-17s and 1 British Spitfire.
Wow, how did he shoot down so many B-17s? Wow.
Well, he was a pretty good pilot. He got shot down 3 times himself, but
wow.
he lived through them.
That's amazing.
He bailed out because Belgium was occupied by the Germans. You know, he was picked up by some German patrol and then put on a train and went back to his base in at Dortmund, Germany, and then he didn't make it through the war, although his story after the war was kind of he could make a book about his life as well.
Yeah, just what I was thinking just now was maybe there should be a book about his life and how he went through three, you know, shot down these planes, the stories behind those, and the stories behind, you know, how it was in Germany after the war kind of thing for him. So
yeah, that was really tough after the war for him.
Yeah.
Germany was just decimated. But So I found Hans Berger, and it was amazing. I can't even express how thrilled I was when I found him, because my dad just knew that he was shot down by two Focke-Wulf German fighters. And then to find out, that exactly who shot him down, and then to communicate with him and become friends with him is something else. Something else.
Perfect. I will ask you a question just for my own curiosity's sake. Is did he talk about his plan of attack to shoot down your dad's B-17?
Well, at 94 years old, a lot of things just kind of all blend together for Hans.
Yeah, sure.
And so all he remembers from that day is that he attacked the B-17. He shot down, and they shot him down. They actually shot each other down.
Oh, really? Oh, wow.
Yeah, and that he bailed out of the plane, and when he was coming down in his parachute, he could see some of the parachutes of the crew members of my dad's plane coming down.
Yeah.
And but he that that's about all he can remember from
Wow. Huh. Yeah.
from that day.
Yeah, no, it's pretty amazing to have that, to have even have that little bit of a story though, just about his the other side of it. It's always neat to kind of get the veterans of the enemy to kind of give their stories too. So it's
Oh yeah, when I went over to visit him in Munich, and I went, we had lunch, and then went to his apartment to film the interview.
Yeah.
And he brought out his pilots, his bomber, his fighter pilot jacket with his Iron Cross on it, and he had all
Really?
these
Wow.
pictures that he showed me. And there's pictures of him in the book, but some of these pictures he showed me were really amazing. They were taken by the gun camera on these fighter planes, and so you see the sights of the gun camera, I mean of the gun,
Yeah.
and then you'll see like a B-17 or a B-24 or a P-51 Mustang and these gun sights, some of them that are on fire. I mean, that's really eerie.
Wow, that's the thing is you think about how our fighters had gun cameras. I would never think that the German fighters also had gun cameras, and they would take them back probably back and analyze them just like we did for our forces probably.
But in retrospect, sometimes when I'm doing my presentations, somebody will ask me, "Well, don't you hate the German pilot that shot down your dad's plane?" And I don't really. He was just pretty much like the U.S. airman. He was 19, 20-year-old guy, thrown into this. He's fighting for his country, just trying to do a job and trying to stay alive. And Hans said that, it was unfortunate they had to be shooting at each other, but that was their duty. That was their job.
Yeah, exactly. That's just a great point. He's just doing what he's supposed to be doing. So, great point there. So he's shot down. Your father jumps out of the plane, I assume, and he's floating down to the Belgian countryside. His other crew members are going down too. He knows that there's at least eight chutes, right? Does he know that when he's floating down?
No, he knows really nothing. All he knows is the plane, a B-17, really is kind of divided in two, with the bomb bay separating the front of the plane from the back of the plane. So my dad knew what was going on in the front of the plane. So in the plexiglass nose, you had the bombardier and the navigator. And then he and the co-pilot, and then the flight engineer or the top turret gunner stood right behind the pilots. So he was aware of what happened to those guys, but he had no idea what was taking place in the back of the plane behind the bomb bay. The plane caught on fire. We had all this noise, these 20 millimeter cannon shells ripping into the plane. From the fighter planes, and the guns of the gunners from his plane, firing, and then the oxygen tanks blew up, knocked him out actually for a few moments. And when he came to, the cockpit was on fire. He couldn't put it out. He was yelling through the intercom to bail out, but he didn't, I think the intercom was out. And he told the guys at the front of the plane to bail out. And he was being the commander of the plane. He was the last one to bail out of the plane. So he jumped, and that's what he knew. When he came down, you know, he had no idea the condition or of the other nine members of his crew. When he came down in some trees. It was February, so there was snow on the ground. There was no leaves on the tree. And his parachute got hung up in the trees, and he was dangling 20 feet off the ground, and he couldn't get down. But fortunately for him, a couple Belgian farmers came and saw his plight. And fortunately for my dad, you know, they got to him before the Germans did. They went back to the farmhouse, got a ladder and a rope, and helped him down a tree. And those trees, there's pictures of those trees and that specific tree in the book. I mentioned earlier, there's over 200 time period photographs in the book about the people and the places where the events took place that were either given to me by Dr. Delahaye or Jacques Lalot or helpers of my dad who sent him the pictures after the war. So you can visualize everything that you're reading about. So that he came down, it was early afternoon, and they told him to stay put because they thought it was too dangerous to move him during the day with German patrols in the area. So he hid, and then that night they came back and got him and took him to the farmhouse of Edmund and Ivan Durvin. Raymond Durvin was one of the two Belgium men that helped him out of the tree. The other was Henri Franken. So he stayed there in that farmhouse one night. They thought it was too dangerous for him to stay there any longer because of the German patrols combing the area. So that night, a Belgium's customs officer, Paul Tilquin, came in a tandem bicycle to move him to another location. And with him, he brought some of his uniform. They had the Belgium customs officers, they wore the cape and a little pillbox hat. And so they started off on this bicycle. It was the middle of the night, pitch black, raining. My dad could only pedal with one leg because he had shrapnel wounds in his other leg. And they came to this hill, and they weren't able to pedal any further, so they started pushing the bike up to the top of the hill. When they got to the top, there was a little cabaret or cafe there. The lights were on, music was playing, there was laughter, loud talking. All of a sudden, two German Luftwaffe officers come walking out. Their arms were around two young girls, I guess Belgian girls, and they were drunk as skunks, my dad said. And they were, you know, real gregarious, you know, being drunk. And one of them comes up and starts talking. They start talking to Paul and my dad. And this one guy puts his arm around my dad, asks for a light for a cigarette. My dad can't speak French or
Belgian.
Speak German. Well, in Belgium, actually, it's interesting. Belgium's divided almost in two. The northern half of Belgium is called Flanders, where they speak Dutch.
Sure.
And the southern half of Belgium is called Wallonia, where they speak French. So it's kind of a unique country.
Yeah.
So they all speak French and right there in southern Belgium. But Paul could understand this guy, and he gave him a light for his cigarette. And evidently, these German officers were too drunk and too interested with their girls to pay any further attention to these two guys pushing a bike up the hill in the rain. So they let him go.
Wow.
And after that, my dad was moved from place to place. How often he stayed in any given home depended on how brave the people were who lived there and how dangerous the Belgium underground thought it was for him to stay there. He might stay one night at a house. He might spend, you know, 6 weeks at a house. It varied, and he was moved around from place to place. Normally, when the underground helped down airmen, they tried to get him back to England, down through various escape routes into France, over the Pyrenees into Spain, and then out through British-controlled Gibraltar. But something always went wrong trying to get my dad out.
Yeah.
And you can only imagine how stressful that must have been for him. You know, first of all, he comes, his plane's shot down, it's on fire, he's got to bail out. He comes down in a foreign country, has no idea where he is, doesn't know what happened to his buddies on the crew, can't communicate with the military, and he's being helped by people that he has no idea who they are. He can't communicate with them, can't speak the language at that point. And any one of these people might be a collaborator and turn him over to the Gestapo, the German secret police.
Sure.
And when he's hiding these houses, you know, the Gestapo could break in at any time, day or night, and arrest him and either send him to a POW camp or shoot him. And there were several instances that are described in the book about him almost being discovered and caught. And as I mentioned earlier, these people that hid my dad, he owed them his life. He would have been captured without their help. He said they would let him sleep in their bed. They'd sleep on the floor. They'd give him the largest portion of food. Just wonderful people. But finally, my dad just got tired and fed up of hiding. I guess he got tired of being the hunted. And he had heard word got through that the Allies had landed at Normandy on June 6th, D-Day. And so he knew that the U.S. four armies were going to be coming up through France. And he decided to get back in the fight. So he joined the French resistance with the Mackie, it was called. And the French resistance, or Mackie, was made up of there were small groups, independent groups of guerrillas located all over France. His group was made up of about 20 guys led by a French lieutenant who had escaped from a German prisoner of war camp. There were a few Frenchmen, Belgians, and some Algerians who my dad said were especially fierce fighters. And the French resistance, the Mackie, their job was basically to harass the Germans. They got their instructions through coded messages by the British through the BBC, and then they were supplied by airdrops from the British. And so my dad started, basically, their mission was, like I said, to harass the Germans, to disrupt communication, sabotage railroad lines, attack German convoys, assassinate German officers, and there's several instances described in my book of encounters my dad had with the Germans while he was fighting with the French resistance.
No, that's fantastic. The again, it's that where you just kind of, he's getting tired of sitting around. He wants to get out and do his bit kind of thing. So maybe he's just plain bored of hiding too, you know.
Yeah, well, also, you know, he was in the infantry for a year before he went into the Air Force, so he did have, you know, training, you know, as in ground fighting. So yeah. I think that played into it too. But for him to make the decision, because if the Germans got him while he was fighting with resistance, he would have been shot on the spot, no questions asked.
Yeah.
No, so he took, you know, his life in his hands by, you know, he could have stayed hidden until the U.S. armies came up through France after D-Day and liberated Belgium, but decided not to. So that took a lot of guts on his part to do that. I don't know how many people, myself included, would have been had the fortitude to make that decision.
No, yeah, that's a great point. And how does it end up for him? When does he finally get rescued or liberated by the forces?
Well, finally, 7 months after he bailed out, actually, it was the Mackie group. They had set an ambush for a German convoy, and my dad said the information they got from the British was unbelievably accurate. If they said a convoy is coming up this road on this date at this time, sure enough, they'd be there. And I guess that's as a result of the British cracking the German Enigma code and knew all the troop movements during the war. Winston Churchill said that by the British being able to crack the Germans' code and knowing all their instructions, that shortened the war by 2 years. But while they were waiting, had this ambush, word came that there were U.S. troops in a nearby village of Treslon, France. So my dad hiked on over there and walked into the town square and went up to a major army major, actually was Patton's Third Army that had come up through France after D-Day, and identified himself as a downed U.S. airman. They interrogated him to make sure he wasn't some German spy, and they verified he was who he said he was. And then he went to Paris, and then by transport back to England, and then eventually back to the States.
Wow, that's amazing. Where was his theater of operations for being a partisan or being a guy behind the lines? Where was he fighting the most actions in those sorts in France?
Just northern France, just across the border from Belgium.
Okay.
In fact, the farmhouse where he went the first night, which there's a pit, which is still there today, and the farmhouse where he stayed with the French resistance, that's still there today too. But the farmhouse that he first stayed in that first night after being shot down, the house is in Belgium, but there's trees behind the house which are in France, so it's right at the French-Belgium border.
Wow. Huh.
And so they would all the action with the Mackie group was either in very southern Belgium or very northern France.
Wow. That's so he just kind of stayed in that location and just kind of stayed low and
Yeah, because there were these resistance group, these guerrilla groups. They were, you know, had they were based all over the place, and they just had kind of a little territory that they fought in.
yeah, no, that's fantastic. Good stuff. It's good to hear the story has a happy ending. That was a good point. I did have a story that was not such a happy ending for this person's grandfather. It's good to hear that he did come back from the war and he had this almost epic journey of fighting in the Air Force and fighting for the partisan resistance. Great
Yeah,
stuff.
there's not too many guys that were shot down and then ended up fighting with the resistance.
Yeah.
Most guys either stayed in hiding or they got out through these escape networks and got back to England. You mentioned, you know, the happy ending. For some it was, and for some it wasn't. My dad's 10-man crew, five of them came back home, but five of them did not.
And we will find out those stories from the book, right?
Exactly.
We will save it for the book for those stories of those men. And did you
Yeah,
go
because
into
the book goes into detail about what happened to each guy.
Oh,
Something
perfect.
different happened to each of the crew. So the book's just not about my dad. It's about what happened to each member of the crew, and also about all the Belgian people that risked their lives trying to help them. The first half of the book builds up to the day that the plane was shot down,
Sure.
and then the second half of the book is all about what happened after that.
Yeah, it's a great point to kind of learn about their escape. This isn't like the Great Escape movie, is it? Kind of that idea where they're escaping from prison of war camps.
No, some of them became POWs, but no of them escaped from a POW camp.
Yeah, no, that's great. Good stuff. Trying to think if there's any last questions. Any last thoughts? Where can we here's something. Where can we find your book? And tell us a little bit about the process. My understanding that we talked off air is this is a self-published book, which is amazing to me that you did that. So tell us where to find the book, how do we find you, and what's the website?
Okay, well, when I finished writing the manuscript, you know, I'd never written a book. I had no writing background or training at all. I had a 40-year career in sales and sales management. So I had to find out, well, how do you publish this thing? So I went on the internet and I looked at various methods of publishing the book. And I really wanted this to be a professionally done book. I wanted something I could really be proud of and you know, and promote. And after looking at various ways of publishing a book, I decided to form my own publishing company. So I formed a one-person LLC, Seabreeze Publishing, which is the name of the street that I live on in Seal Beach, California.
Yeah.
And then I contracted with independent professionals for all the associated services, such as editing the book, cover layout, interior design, or interior layout, cover design, printing the book, fulfillment. And so I oversaw all that. And from the time I started my research to the time the book was published was 4.5 years. And then the finished product was something I was very proud of. It's won 25 book awards, since it was released in August of 2014. So I'm very proud of that. And also, it's carried in the gift stores of all the major air museums and war museums across the United States, the World War II Museum in New Orleans, Mighty Eighth Museum in Georgia, the National Museum of the U.S. Air Force in Dayton, Ohio, at Wright-Patterson, and many others. As far as locating the book, you can really get it any place where books are sold. Most books are sold on Amazon. Over 50% of all books are sold on Amazon, but it's available at Barnes and Noble. If anyone wants a signed copy of my book, they can go to my website, which is stevesnyderauthor.com. On the homepage, you go scroll down to the bottom. There's a buy now little button. You can click on that, and I'll send you a signed and autographed book.
No, that's a perfect place to find you. And also you're on the Amazon and all the normal locations too to find books too, right?
Right. Also, I have a couple different Facebook pages. I have my personal page, Steve Snyder page, and then also Steve Snyder, author of Shot Down, that book page.
Perfect. And that the one point that we talked about off air is we are both going to be at the Memphis Belle in May. I think May 19th, I think is the May 19th, 20th, 21st. So listeners, we will definitely bump into Steve there and have a little bit in-person interview with him and talk to him about the book. And this podcast had already been released at the time that we will be meeting at that time. So listeners, look forward to that. And if you're any Ohio listeners, feel free to drop by and see the Memphis Belle and take a look at it. It's a little really quickly, was the Memphis Belle the roof for a gas station at some point?
No, that was the Lacey Lady
Oh, really? Okay.
in Oregon. It was on top of a gas station in McMinnville, Oregon.
Gotcha.
Actually, now that's been taken down, and the B-17 Alliance in Salem, Oregon, is trying to reconstruct the plane and restore the plane. So if I've gone up there the last 3 years to sign copies of my book at their air show, Warbirds Over the West, and at the Salem airport to help support and
Yeah.
that cause. So yeah, that's called the Lacey Lady. The Memphis Belle, it's the most iconic B-17 there is. It's an F model. It was one of the earlier F models. It was the first bomber to complete 25 missions and return to the United States. There were two bombers that actually completed 25 missions before the Memphis Belle, the B-24 Hot Stuff and a B-17 Hells Angels, but they didn't come back to the U.S. But it is the most iconic and really the only plane that's still around that saw heavy combat during the war. And so it's going to be a great event. I'll be there at the Air Force Museum on the 18th, 19th, and 20th in the gift store signing copies of my book. And it's going to be exciting. There's a couple other, at least two other B-17s, the Texas Raiders and the Yankee Lady, that are going to be flying in for it. So there'll be more than one bomber. The Memphis Belle is going to be on static display. They don't want to risk flying that anymore. But the other bombers, the B-17s that are there, will be flying, and they'll take people up for rides for a fee.
Yeah,
So it's going to be an exciting event.
I think it's $400 or something along those lines for
Yeah,
$500.
I think 450. But
Yeah.
I've been up twice, and it's a thrill of a lifetime. It's
Right.
definitely a bucket list thing,
Yeah.
and anyone who does it always says it was worth it.
Yeah. No, it's yeah. I've saw that recently in the summer. I saw a B-17. They were doing that. I always thought maybe I should do that. Maybe I should do that. So yeah, it's been a great episode for myself and for the listeners. And Steve, I'd like to thank you so much for being on the podcast with us and talking about your book. I will see you in a couple days from the release of this podcast. So stay tuned, listeners. We'll have more in-depth coverage about this book also with Steve. So.
Thank you very much, Rob. I greatly appreciate it and enjoyed it a lot.
Yeah, we'll see you soon, and thanks so much for the podcast.
It is our duty to remember.